Hello there, everyone in Radio Land. We're live. We're live, right? Okay, they're telling me we're live. Bob's not in studio, and I'm not sure what to do. Oh, they're handing me a script. Let me go ahead and read this. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. This is Bob. You know, I don't think I can pronounce his last name. Does anybody know how to pronounce his last name? Oh, Gene Cook. You can pronounce his last name? Okay, go right ahead.
And another pastor by the name of Bob Earnyardt, E-N-Y-R-A-T, who is the pastor of Denver Bible Church. And he's having a conversation with Bob Earnyardt. Pastor Bob Earnyardt, who's the pastor of Denver Bible Church in Denver, Colorado.
Well, Gene did his best. Hey, this is Will Duffy. You're listening to Bob Earnyardt Live. While Bob's out of the studio, enjoy this show. And it's Bob with creationist Walt Brown.
One morning, there's truth of a day.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Earnyardt, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. My favorite scientist is Dr. Walt Brown. He wrote a best-selling book, In the Beginning, on creation and the global flood. Walt Brown authored the hydroplate theory, which explains 25 major features of the Earth and its environment, and he's made many scientific predictions. This is what I enjoyed reading his book. Many predictions that have since been proved to be true, and he continues to publish others based on his hydroplate theory that the global flood resulted after the Earth's crust broke open and released water from a subterranean sea beneath the Earth's crust. Well, Walt Brown received a PhD in mechanical engineering from MIT, where he was a National Science Foundation Fellow. He has taught college courses in physics, mathematics, and computer science. Walt is a retired full colonel from the Air Force, a West Point graduate, and former Army Ranger and paratrooper. He has taught science at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, and he was the chief of science and technology studies at the Air War College. Wow, just reading all that gets me tired. You've done a lot in your life. Walt Brown, welcome to Bob Earnyardt Live.
Nice to be with you, Bob.
Hey, Walt, for most of your life, you were an evolutionist, but you started investigating the theory critically. So let me ask you some questions.
Okay.
To start off with, naturalistic evolution requires life to originate by chance. You've considered that. How plausible is it that life could start by chance?
It's very implausible, and believe it or not, most evolutionists know it. And that's why very few are doing research in the area. They consider it almost a dead end. Mm. 20, 30, 40 years ago, it was a hot topic.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all sorts of theories put out, but they've been pretty much exploded.
At our home, we homeschool our kids, and we were looking at a Harvard animation of the inner life of a cell. And they made it for their biology students, and we thought, hey, this is pretty good for 6-year-old homeschool kids also. And it is so awesome to see the complexity within a single living cell. Just folding a single protein is so wildly complicated. A cell is so awesomely designed and intricate.
When Darwin wrote his book, Origin of Species, the conceptual picture of a living cell was as simple as a ping pong ball.
Mm.
Since then, high-powered microscopes and many discoveries, the most significant, in my opinion, is that of DNA, have been found. Every cell, with a very, very minor exception, every cell has in it this genetic material, DNA, in humans, 23 pairs of chromosomes that hold that genetic material in every cell. And that alone throws the whole issue in a trash can. Mm. It couldn't have evolved because the DNA is coded information. And Bob, as you know, information only comes about through intelligence. Physics, natural processes, do not produce information.
They don't produce information.
In fact, they destroy it.
We get into debates with evolutionists who claim, like on theologyonline.com, one of my favorite websites, evolutionists who claim that evolution is not about an increase in information. It's hysterical. It's as though these scientists, and we're talking about biologists and others on this website, who they pretend that evolution has nothing to do with information.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's actually what we come up against. Now, DNA requires proteins.
Right.
And the proteins are made, they're defined by the DNA.
Right. There's a chicken and an egg problem there.
Right.
You need, at a minimum, 75 different proteins in the cell in order for the DNA to work.
Mm-hmm.
And the DNA is the only thing that produces the protein.
Right.
So which came first?
And they're so wildly complex, like I'm saying, that video from the intelligent design community, Unlocking the Mystery of Life,
right,
just so awesome that we have these tools to show people the wonderful complexity of the living cell. Well, let's step up a level from microbiology to looking at organisms.
Uh-huh.
Evolutionists say that organs and limbs that they develop because there was apparently some need, and then natural selection would take the small improvements and make things like wings. You'd have a creature with legs, and then eventually the creature would get wings by natural selection.
Right. First of all, we must distinguish between microevolution and macroevolution. Microevolution only involves small changes from an organism to its offspring that involve changes in size, shape, color, or minor genetic changes. Mm. Now, those changes do occur. That's called microevolution. Micro means small. Mm-hmm. Macroevolution is something quite different. Macro means large, involves increases in complexity, like a limb, a leg, for example, evolving into a wing, or like scales evolving into a feather, or like a one-chamber heart evolving from who knows what, or a two-chamber heart evolving from a one-chamber heart, or a three-chamber heart evolving from a four-chamber.
Right.
That's macroevolution. It's never been observed. And there have been all sorts of experiments, Bob, trying to cause it to happen.
And even among microorganisms, National Geographic just put out an article this past month where in one drop of amber, they have found an entire world of microorganisms of bacteria, fungus, algae, protozoans, and they said that scientists are startled to see that after 220 million years, there's been virtually no evolution whatsoever. These are identical to modern organisms.
That's right. And in some of those amber specimens, Bob, they can identify the social interactions between, say, insects. They're the same as they are today.
Hmm.
And those things, they say, I'm quite confident they're wrong, are hundreds of millions of years old.
Right. And so if these bacteria, we're told, would evolve much faster than would larger organisms, then you would think after 220 million years old, we'd see wild differences.
That's right. But bacteria go through a life cycle in an hour or two.
Hmm.
And humans go through a life cycle in 20, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So according to evolution, bacteria should be evolving very rapidly. Mm-hmm. You should see these changes, which evolutionists say are happening so slow at our scale, at the human scale, that they can't see them. But you should be able to see them in some of these smaller organisms.
Well, that's right, as we're studying them today. And in this one drop of amber, there's a quarter of a billion years worth of opportunity for evolution.
Yeah.
And they don't see it.
But back to the limbs and the wing that you mentioned.
Yeah, legs turning into...
That would be a macro change.
All right.
It's not size, shape, color. Just think about it. For a reptile to evolve into a bird, and that's what the evolutionists say happened, you would have to have a limb of the reptile changing to a wing. Now, imagine that. Wouldn't you expect, before a reptile's leg evolved into a wing, that it would become a bad leg long before it became a good wing?
Okay, now...
In other words, there's a no-man's zone in between that limb and the wing.
Yeah.
And you can't go through that zone without killing the thing.
Well, this is what they say. They say natural selection can do this because these gradual changes will help the organism survive better. And so when you tell that to a million students, they say, oh, okay, and so then they evolve flight because that helped them survive. But how does a creature that gets around on four legs, how does he end up surviving with a leg that's a lousy leg and it's a lousy wing?
Right.
It's halfway on the way to being a wing. I mean, that would destroy his chances of survival.
That's right. You might say, well, if we could walk from North America to Europe, we would be so much better in Europe for some reason. But getting there, you got to go through an ocean.
Right.
And just by saying we'll go through the ocean slowly doesn't help you.
Yeah, right.
For that reptile to go from four legs to two wings and two legs slowly doesn't help it.
And we could multiply these kinds of examples by the hundreds or
thousands,
even the thousands.
Thousands, that's right.
Right, exactly. And sexual reproduction, for example, that you need a male and a female of a species,
right,
and they have to be able to mate.
They've got to be compatible. And they've got to be compatible in six or seven different areas.
Mm.
And most people just think of the physical compatibility. And we're not talking about just humans. We're talking about millions of species, including plants. They've got to be compatible physically. They've also got to be compatible emotionally, compatible chemically.
Emotionally, in other words, the female of the species has to say, okay, I'll agree to this.
That's right. Or the male.
Or the male.
That's
both.
Right. That's not one side, this thing.
You know? No, that's a good point. Back in the early 70s, I learned a weird bit of biological information that somehow stuck with me, that it had to do with a mosquito. Mm-hmm. And the reproduction cycle of a mosquito, if I remember this correctly, requires the bottom half of that insect, the abdomen, to rotate 180 degrees and then lock into place, and then it stays that way the rest of his life. And if it did not do that, he could not reproduce. That's the way they reproduce.
Right.
And so that example, like you said, we can multiply these by the thousands. How does the first mosquito couple get around to reproducing when they have to go, the male has to go through that kind of a change just in order for this species to survive?
And you know, another compatibility is electrical compatibility. In the human, when the sperm touches the egg for the first time, an electrical current goes from the sperm head to the egg, and that sends a signal to the egg, don't let any other sperm fertilize the egg.
Mm.
If that didn't work, if that electrical circuit wasn't there, and all the equipment that's involved in that electrical circuit, then there'd be multiple fertilizations, and the organism wouldn't develop.
Wow. We have twins and triplets and quadruplets now and then, but imagine having 60 or 80 sperm fertilize one egg all the time.
Well, the egg wouldn't develop. It wouldn't go through the normal embryo cycles.
Mm.
So
we had an endocrinologist from a college in New York City on the show, and he mentioned that when that egg is fertilized, as the egg is still in the fallopian tube, it sends out a chemical signal, basically a cry to the mother that I'm here, get ready to feed me.
Yes.
Now, that's one tiny little process.
Yes.
That if we had to wait for it to evolve by chance, it would be bizarre, just the possibility of just that chemical signal going to the mother to tell her, get ready for me, I'm here now. These are not things that could happen one chance in 100 trillion. They're just basically impossible.
Right. Exactly.
Wow. Okay, so when we look at evolution at that level, that information needs to build up through natural processes, we know that that doesn't happen, and mutations cause destruction. They don't improve.
That's right. The changes go in the downhill direction.
Yeah. So But let's say, let's ignore that. We know that it can't work. Let's ignore that. If it could work, evolution requires eons of time, millions, billions of years. Mm-hmm. Is there evidence against an old Earth that you are aware of? We've been collecting some here at Bob and Yurt Live. Like, I'd like to ask you about carbon-14. Could you explain how it is that carbon-14 is found in things that are supposedly millions of years old?
Well, first of all, carbon-14 cannot be found in things that are that old. Carbon-14, the oldest something can be dated with carbon-14 is maybe 60, 70,000 years. If there's any carbon-14 in the specimen, it's got to be, according to their assumptions, it's got to be less than 70,000 years. Now, there are radiometric dating techniques other than radiocarbon that get into the millions and billions of years.
Like potassium, argon, and so on.
That's right. Uranium to lead is probably the most well-known, but it's not used anymore because it's got all sorts of problems with it that students aren't really told, and, and many professors don't even know it.
Well, let's talk about first carbon-14 then. So after carbon-14 breaks down, it has a half-life of, what,
5,730 years.
Okay. 5,730 years. So if you have 1,000 carbon-14 atoms, after 5,700 years, you're going to only have 500 atoms.
Right.
And so
another 5,700 years, you'll have 250.
Yeah. And so theoretically, the oldest something could be, and we could still detect carbon-14 in it, is 60, 70,000 years old or so.
Right.
And there are many things on the Earth that evolutionist scientists say are millions or even billions of years old, including coal and oil, gas.
But you know, Bob, every specimen that can be radiocarbon dated, every one, including diamonds, including coal, including manure, including trees, buried trees, has radiocarbon or carbon-14, another name for it, in it, meaning that they've all got to be less than 60 or 70,000 years.
In other words, it's not here and there an anomaly where they find some and they think, wow, maybe that was a corrupted specimen or something. But everywhere scientists are testing for radiocarbon, carbon-14, everywhere they are finding it, even in dinosaur bones.
That's right.
And how long has that been known, that when we do look for carbon-14, we find it in things that are supposedly millions of years old?
I first ran across it in a paper, a man that I got to know 25 years ago pretty well, that he wrote. So it's been known for at least 25 years.
A quarter century.
Right. And dinosaurs, remember, are at least 65 million years old.
By theory.
By theory. So why is there radiocarbon still in their bones?
Right. Dr. Brown, you heard a phone conversation I had with a scientist, and I'd rather not give the details of it on the show right now, but we were asking a scientist to take dinosaur bones that they had and do a test, carbon-14 test, to see whether there's carbon-14 in it. You recall hearing that phone call?
Oh, I certainly do, Bob, and he was a very famous scientist.
Yeah, he was very famous, and we're still following up with him. That's why I don't want to give the details
now. People have seen the movie Jurassic Park.
Right.
They saw him represented in that movie.
Well, that's true. That is true. And so this scientist, we were offering a lot of money for them to carbon-14 date this dinosaur that they had excavated.
Right. With honest techniques.
Yeah.
There's a blind technique called blind testing.
Right.
It's done by every credible scientist who wants to remove personal bias from the system. It's done in the medical business. Blind testing is very important.
Yeah, so we asked them to do a blind carbon-14 test of five specimens, one of this dinosaur, and we offered to give a grant to their museum of $23,000, and he just flatly turned it down because, if you recall, he was afraid of what the creationist movement could get out of such a test.
Yes, and his involvement in it would have made him persona non grata among his contemporaries, his colleagues, and could have ruined his career.
Yeah. I had an opportunity to go with a geologist from the USGS here in Denver. The United States Geological Survey, worked for the government for 30 years. And we took a tour of one of our church members owns a mountain. We call it Arts Mountain. And there are dinosaur fossils in the mountain, the Morrison strata, Dakota strata. Mm-hmm. And so we spent half a day with this scientist, and we were showing him evidence, arguments that these strata formed rapidly. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, no, we have tested these. We've done potassium, argon, whatever. We've tested these. We know that they're old. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, did you do blind tests? And he said, oh, no, we didn't do that. I said, have you ever in your career done or seen done a blind test, radioactive test, to determine the age of a strata? And he said, no, we don't do that. And I asked him, why not? He said, well, we're professionals. There's no bias there that we would put into the results. And the labs that do the test, they ask all kinds of details. They want to know, where did the specimen come from? What is it? How old do you think it is?
Right, right.
It was sort of startling for me to hear it firsthand.
Right, and we all have biases. That's why a blind test, and maybe we should explain it to the listeners, is important. Think of a medical procedure that is being developed. You don't know if it's good or bad. Let's say it's a pill. What the Food and Drug Administration requires is a blind test. In other words, set up two groups of people to be experimented on. One's called the test group and the other's called the control group. And the individuals in it, usually there are thousands, do not know which group they're in. They're going to get a pill. They don't know if it's the real pill or if it's a fake pill, what's called a placebo, like a sugar pill, that will have no effect upon them. So they get these pills. They don't know if they're getting the pill that's supposed to help them, nor do the doctors know which patient is getting the real McCoy.
Mm-hmm.
And then after years of testing, other doctors come along and they say, okay, which person was helped, which person apparently was helped, which wasn't, and then they uncover, were they getting the real pill or the fake.
Right.
And then they do a statistical test, and they say, is this statistically significant?
Hmm.
And that procedure is done on anything that the Food and Drug Administration approves, be it a pill or a method.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important in science. We all have biases, and I want to hold my hand up and say I've got,
sure,
very, very strong biases.
Sure. A bias basically is a belief that leads us to make an incorrect conclusion or assessment.
Right. That's why everything I say needs to be tested, mm-hmm, in a way that I can't control the outcome.
Okay, so we find carbon-14 everywhere we look for it, including in dinosaur bones and diamonds that are millions of years
old. In former things that we're living.
Right. Mm-hmm. Organic things. You don't carbon-14...
a rock.
Right, exactly.
Most rocks.
Okay, and then let me ask you this. They've also been finding bacteria, like I mentioned, from National Geographic, mm-hmm, but not only bacteria and protein molecules in fossils that are supposedly millions of years old and even over a billion, but they've even found living bacterial spores in the intestines of bees. I got this from your book in the beginning.
Right.
That are supposedly, you know, 30, 40 million years old.
And older.
And older.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That's all evidence of these things shouldn't be happening if, in fact, they were really millions of years old. Real quickly, volcanic sediments on the Earth, you point out that there's about a cubic mile of volcanic sediments spewed from volcanoes every year.
Right.
And so if the Earth was 4 billion years old, 4.5 billion years old, there's like 4 billion years of missing volcanic sediment out there.
That's right. And there's an assumption under that, underlying that. There's an assumption underlying almost every scientific dating technique. And what everybody should think about, including grade school children and professors, is what are those assumptions? Most professors don't even think about it.
Right. The assumption there is that the rate would have been steady for all that
time.
That's
right. But let's think about it. If the evolution story is correct, the Earth was once molten, lots of volcanic activity as it was starting to form and so forth, there would be more volcanic debris settling through the atmosphere.
Right.
In the past. Even thicker layers around.
So that volcanic sediment, it's missing. Billions of years worth is missing.
That's right.
Continental erosion. Your book, you point out that the continents would erode in about 25 million years, yet they show us fossils of dinosaurs and sea creatures high up in the mountains.
That's right, where erosion should be the greatest.
Yeah, and these things they say are 300 million years old or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, we've got to go back to what are the assumptions, constant rate of erosion.
Right.
Where we're looking, it should be even greater.
Right, on the mountaintops.
Right.
And then we have meteorites. They're found in shallow strata.
Almost all meteorites have been found in such shallow strata that they've got to be recent.
Telling us that the deposition on the Earth's surface happened rapidly as a result of a global flood, about a mile deep of sedimentary layer around the Earth.
Right. And I said almost all meteorites. The one exception is up in Scandinavia. They found scads of meteorites in a, say, a square mile area. And they were deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd say, well, those were some deep examples. But then why did so many meteorites land so close together?
Mm. And the hydroplate theory, which we will get into on the next show, will, I think, help us to answer that question.
Right.
And then also the nickel that should be in 4 billion years worth of meteoritic dust.
Yes.
We've got all that nickel missing. So this will just whet the taste of the audience, I hope, Dr. Walt Brown, to tune in for the next few shows as we continue this interview. So I want to thank you very much for joining us, and with your okay, we'll continue on tomorrow's show.
That'll be great, Bob.
All right, that's so super. I want to let the audience know you could read In the Beginning for free on the Internet, In the Beginning, at creationscience.com. Also here at Bob and Yurt Live, for some years now, we've been selling, it's a beautiful hardbound book by Dr. Walt Brown, In the Beginning, Compelling Evidence for Creation and the Flood. You can call us to order that at 1-800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. Or you can go to our website, kgov.com. KGOV.com, click on the store, and literature, you'll find this book, you could read all about it. It's just tremendous. In the Beginning, and guess what? If you call this week, we will send you a signed copy of Dr. Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning. That'll be exciting. And for those in Colorado, Maranatha Christian Center. What a great Christian school. Maranatha in Arvada. Check them out. And our website is KGOV, KGOV.com. May God bless you. Hi, this is Bob Enyart. If you'd like to hear more, then tune in weekdays at 3 right here on KLTT for Bob Enyart Live. Also, you could subscribe to our Bob Enyart Live Bible studies, our monthly videos, our sermons. For the Bible studies, you get an entire album on audio tape or MP3 CD for $34.95 a month. Or you could get our videos or sermons every month mailed to you for just $24.95 a month. To subscribe, please call 800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. That's 800-836-9278. Or you could subscribe online at kgov.com. Also, Denver Bible Church, you're invited Sunday morning or evening for Bible study, worship, and fellowship. We have such a great time together, so come on out or check us out on the web at kgov.com for Bob and Yart Live.